In this part of Focus 580, we have as our guest historian Ira Berlin, a man who is generally considered to be one of, if not the leading scholar in this country of slavery. He's a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland, and this spring has been spending the spring here on the U of I campus, teaching and talking about his area of research. He has authored several books, including Slaves Without Masters, The Free Negro in the Antebellum South, which won the first book prize of the National Historical Society, another Many Thousands Gone, The First Two Centuries of Slavery in North America, won a number of awards, including the Bancroft Prize for the best book in American history, his most recent, which in a sense carries on the work of Many Thousands Gone. The most recent is titled Generations of Captivity, A History of African-American Slaves, that makes some very basic points about slavery, and perhaps the most basic is that it was not a static kind of institution, that indeed slavery over time changed, and from one area of the colonies to another, it was different. That book is out and came out just last year, so you certainly can find it in the bookstore or the library if you want to take a look at it. He is, in addition to his teaching here, he will be giving a public talk about some of the research that he has done on the topic Rethinking Slavery 1800 to 1861. It's free, open to the public at 3:30 in the afternoon, Friday of next week. This is April 9th, we're talking about, in room 213 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. So if you're interested, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're interested, you can certainly attend. And of course, if you'd like to read his work, you can head out and look for the books. Here, though, in this part of the program, we're also interested in taking phone calls, questions, comments. You can join us by dialing the number here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
One of the things, as I explained, one of the things as I was sitting down and thinking about what kind of conversation that we might have, that I came across was an op-ed piece that you wrote and appeared in the Washington Post in 1997. At the time, and if people will recall, this was when Bill Clinton was president of the United States. And he was talking about how it is that we might address the issues of race and the divisions between black and white Americans. And he put forth the proposition that perhaps what we should do, that is what the United States should do in a formal kind of a way, is to issue an apology for slavery, apologize to African Americans for slavery and its legacy. And he was, some people said they thought that would be a good thing. He was also widely ridiculed for having said that. And, but it certainly did touch off discussion of the issue. And here you wrote this piece, and the headline on the piece is, "Before we apologize, we should learn what slavery means." That is to say, you know, we ought to know what we're apologizing for before we start thinking about apologies. And maybe we could start there, because one piece that you make very strongly is that while slavery has helped to shape this country, make it the place it is, that most Americans know very little, if anything, about it.
Well, I think that's correct. I think that's a fair statement. It's awkward and often painful to admit your ignorance. But for most of our history, as you said, we are a society. Slavery dominates the American economy. It produces the capital upon which our great economy and great wealth is built. Cotton, rice, tobacco, sugar bring that capital into the country. The people who control slavery, control slaves, are able to use that great wealth to dominate our politics, our presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, through Jackson, Polk, Tyler, and so on and so forth, all slaveholders, substantial slaveholders. A majority of the Supreme Court justices prior to 1860, including the two great chief justices, slaveholders, and of course, the ideal of American society, the great ideal, freedom. we can say, comes precisely out of the experience of slavery. It's a slaveholder who writes the founding statement of American nationality, all men are created equal, precisely because of this great sensitivity on the issue of freedom. And, of course, the great supporters of that ideal and articulators of that ideal, from Richard Allen through Frederick Douglass through Du Bois and Martin Luther King, are slaves or the descendants of slaves. So slavery plays an extraordinarily large role in our society. It's important for us to know something about what it is.
You maybe I would ask you to expand on something that you did touch on, and it's something that I know that you take up in the recent book in Generations of Captivity, and I think also in Thousands Gone, and that is the idea that perhaps when slavery was first in early America, slavery was the United States was, or the colonies was, it was a society with slaves, mm-hmm. but that somewhere a transition occurred from a society with slaves to a slave mm-hmm. society, the term that you use. Yeah. What exactly is the difference between those two things?
Well, what I mean by a society with slaves is a society in which slavery is just one system of labor and one system of social relations among many. And, of course, in early America, that's precisely what slavery was, a system which existed throughout the Atlantic and ended up existing in mainland North America and the American colonies, but existed alongside a variety of other social relations, free labor, indentured servitude, probably the majority of European people at various times were held in a variety of forms of coerced labor relations. So slavery is not an unusual system in that respect. And in a society with slaves, people who enter in slavery participate in the society in a variety of different ways, in economic ways, they use the legal system, they are members of churches and so on. A slave society, what we mean by that is a society in which slavery becomes the dominant social relationship. And as the dominant social relationship and the dominant economic relationship, it informs all other relationships, not simply between master and slave, but between husband and wife, between parents and children, between non-slaveholding whites and slaveholders, ultimately between ruler and rules, because the slaveholders become the ruling class, the dominant social class, and their values then inform the values of the entire society. Now, that those two kinds of societies existed in mainland North America and developed in different times and different places.
Did all of America in some way become a slave society, or was it only the South that was the slave society?
Well, historians argue about that. We can say that all of America had slavery. And that slavery doesn't disappear to the North till the end of the 18th century, and then lingers on in many parts of the North until well into the 19th century. So there are still some 20,000 slaves, say, in New York in the 1820s. That is, in the third decade of the 19th century. We forget about how long slavery lasts. And, of course, there remain people who had been enslaved, and there remain people who own slaves. Then, still beyond that year. Now, whether the northern states became a slave society is a question, as I said, historians argue about. There is some evidence that at some points during the 18th century, the North is, if not a slave society itself, on the verge of becoming a slave society, and it is a society which, of course, is enmeshed in a larger system of production in which slavery is influencing Northern society in very powerful ways. That is, Northerners engage in the slave trade. They insure slave vessels. They supply slave plantations. The Northern economy then becomes heavily invested in slavery, even while the slave population remains at a relatively modest, the 20 to 25%, rather than the 90% it is in South Carolina.
Mm. Well, certainly a point comes where it is where slavery becomes essential to the economy of the South in a way that it was not to the North. Can you imagine things having gone in a different direction?
Well, we certainly can imagine things going in a different direction. As I said, during the middle of the 18th century, when it seems that the North is teetering towards becoming a slave society, part of the reason it is investing so heavily in slave labor during the 1740s and 1750s is because a series of wars in the Atlantic, changes in the economy in Europe, cut off the supply of indentured servitude, that is, white labor from Europe. And as the supply of labor is cut off from Europe, more and more slaves are coming into the northern society. Northerners open up a direct trade with Africa, so they are now importing slaves directly from Africa. It's very possible to imagine how the North could become a slave society. And indeed, if we, you know, if we take this into the 19th century and we think and we talk a little bit about Illinois, that is our own home ground where we're sitting, the Northwest Ordinance eliminates slavery from the territory of Illinois, later the state of Illinois. But of course, there is a powerful movement which comes within an ace of succeeding to roll back the Northwest Ordinance, to bring slaves into Illinois and Indiana and Ohio. And indeed, slaves are brought into Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio under so-called 99-year indentures, a subterfuge for slavery. It is easy to imagine slavery spreading into the Midwest during the 19th century. The difference between the economies of Kentucky and southern Ohio, the difference between the economy of Missouri and Illinois and Indiana is not that great. It certainly could have gone a different way. There was nothing foreordained about the split between North and South. That's a commitment that men make at great cost to themselves. That is the elimination of slavery from the northern states, just as the final elimination of slavery in Civil War is, of course, an enormously costly struggle.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ira Berlin. He is a distinguished university professor at University of Maryland. He's an historian. He's spending this spring here at the campus of the University of Illinois. Major focus of his academic work has been slavery in North America and has written a number of books. The most recent is Generations of Captivity, A History of African American Slaves. That came out last year. So if you're interested, you can seek out the book. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In the same piece that I was talking about, the 97 piece from the Post, you wrote about some of the things that slavery was about. And you write that it was about domination and also that it was about resistance. And maybe we could talk a little bit about those things. And the first, I guess, the thing is that people should never forget is the level of physical violence that was visited upon people as a way of maintaining the system.
Slavery cannot exist without slaveholders having a monopoly of force, being willing to use that force in ways that I think most of us would consider unconscionable. And that force has to be backed up by still a more powerful force, that is the force of the state. when the Union Army arrives in the South after the Emancipation Proclamation, the game is over, and everybody knows the game is over. That monopoly on force has been broken when Toussaint Louverture destroys the slaveholders' power on the island of Saint-Domingue. The game is over. One of the things that slavery is a system of violence. It's the extraction of labor by one group of people who take people's labor, take their creativity, take their lives, use it for their own purpose, and as a result, of course, gain enormous benefits, material benefits, psychological benefits. We can understand those in a variety of ways. So that's one of the things that slavery is. The difficulty in us understanding slavery is that it's also something else which is contradictory, almost the opposite of that the first thing, that violence. Slavery is also life. It's not simply death. Slaves, at great cost to themselves, don't give in to the imposition, to the violence. Instead, they create families, they create a religion and churches, they create systems of learning, they create language, they create philosophy, they create music and dance and cuisine. All of these things are created by slaves in the face of this violence. And in some ways, one of the things that we know is that the period of slavery may be one of the most culturally creative periods in American history, so much so that if we try to extract that which was created during the slave period, the music, the dance, the food, the language, the philosophy, all of those, if we try to somehow extract them from American life and try to imagine what American life would be without the creative impulse of slaves, we realize American life would be greatly impoverished. Our job in trying to come to terms with slavery is to try to somehow understand both of those things and not diminish either one. If we try to somehow diminish the imposition and the violence, we certainly do a great injustice to what slavery was. On the other hand, if we leave out the great creativity, the family life, the religious life, then again we do a great violence to what men and women created at great personal cost to themselves. So somehow, in coming to terms with these two things, we have to keep them in balance and not, deny either one. And it's hard to appreciate, I think, to understand an institution which is our greatest nightmare. The thing that probably, I think, if any of us had a choice to say, if we could go back and do it differently, yeah, we would do it differently, is also a thing which has given us a great, great gift.
I think that's really interesting, and I can appreciate the difficulty there, because mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are people who would make the argument that in talking in at all about the ways in which it affected American culture, and you might say it affected it positively, that you're somehow lessening the other side, you're lessening the physical violence side. And I'm sure that there are some people would say that, that doesn't balance.
Yeah.
It definitely tips to the other side.
That's right. That's right. Because to deny one is to deny the reality of slavery. To deny the other is to deny the reality of slavery. To keep them, and somehow it's just what happened. We somehow have to live in the shadow of both of those, in both of those things. That's our inheritance as Americans. It's a burden. it's not easy to come to terms with those kinds of burdens. It's easier to say, well, you know, didn't really have anything to do with me. My parents got off the boat, you know, in 1880, and they were against slavery then. And my father was against slavery. My grandfather was against slavery. You know, I'm against slavery. It's not me. But the Declaration of Independence is me. The Constitution is me. The Gettysburg Address is me. It is those things that we celebrate as Americans. You can't pick and choose your history. I'm afraid in that package of the things that we honor and we say is us as Americans are some things that we'd rather not unpack.
Yeah. Well, that gets, again, obviously, where I'm underscoring the point you already made, but it gets back to this issue of just how the people need to understand just how deeply the institution of slavery shaped the country, not just in a historical sense, and not just in the 19th century, but where we are right now.
That's correct. For most of our history, we're a slave society. It's not that far away. We probably can get back to people who experienced the slaves directly in one or two generational jumps. There are people who are being interviewed, former slaves who were being interviewed in the 1940s and early 1950s. It's easy to imagine they have children who are alive. Who are alive today, or certainly grandchildren who are alive today. It is not something, you know, which is in some deep, you know, recess of the American past. And there are connections. And for a long time, we've denied those. We've denied those connections. And I think we're trying to come to terms with them. The apology that you started off the show with was one attempt to come to terms with them. The various lawsuits which are going on now against the corporations are an attempt to come to terms with them. The question of reparations, you know, is an attempt to come to terms with them. But there are also other ways. You know, we see a whole variety of popular culture being infused with, again, this attempt to come to terms with slavery. The movies, Beloved, Amistad, Glory. The variety of TV shows. We've got museum exhibits, many, of course, books and CDs and websites and so on. I think all of these are attempt to come to terms to them because slavery is ground zero of our history.
We have a number of callers here. We'll go. We have somebody on cell phone. We'll go. No. Okay. We'll go to line number one, Champagne.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You've come up to part of my question. You started out by saying something about violence being upheld by the state and that it couldn't exist, the violence of slavery, without that being held up by the state. And I wanted to just kind of follow through then with how that evolved into the Jim Crow laws and how that was fought in the civil rights movement. And so, yeah, we have violence in America today, and we often kind of talk about that as being, you know, some kind of cowboy mentality, and we think of that as individual violence. But I guess I'd like you to talk more about systematic violence in our society that might in some ways come out of that old system or being evolved into other systems.
I was speaking to the institution of slavery, and I think there's, as I said, the institution of slavery can't exist without without the muscle of the state being able to come in, put down slave insurrections, capture runaway slaves, back the master up when the master's whip, his gun is not enough. Now the end of slavery, of course, creates a very different dynamic. After with emancipation, at least by constitutional law, everybody is a citizen, and the kind of differentiation that goes on and exploitation that goes on then has to take a different form, and the state will play a very different role in that. In some ways, the system of Jim Crow and segregation and discrimination and disenfranchisement is not a continuation of slavery. It's put in place precisely because you don't have slavery. In other words, you didn't need segregation when you had a slave society. The role of master and slave were quite well defined. They lived in very, very close proximity. It'd be ridiculous to try to segregate yourself from your slaves if you were a slave owner. What you want to do is you want to control them. It's the system of segregation then is developed precisely because you don't have slavery, and you have a constitutional structure which at least promises equality, and it's in that system that you need to create other kinds of systems of a social differentiation and other systems of exploitation.
And those systems were somewhat more regional, and now we have these arguments about states' rights.
Well, it's not clear whether they were somewhat more regional. They certainly took different forms in different regions. But one of the things that we learned when we liquidated the system of segregation, we liquidated it in the South by law, but then when civil rights workers, when freedom marchers moved to the North, they discovered that there was a powerful system of de facto segregation in place in the North, and in some ways that system of de facto segregation, which kind of existed under the radar of legal segregation, was powerful, was insidious, and has turned out to be even more difficult to eliminate than the system of legal segregation.
And do you think the prison system and the violence in the prison system in any way is a legacy of slavery? And I'll stop at that point.
Yeah. I think there may be connections, but I think the connections have to be explored. I think it might be just too easy to collapse the entire history into one. I think there are certainly lots of connections between incarceration and other systems of. Other systems of social control and social domination, but I'm not sure that it's a direct inheritance from chattel bondage.
I want to thank the last caller and go on to next person listening in Chicago. This is line number 4.
Hi. I want to turn the conversation back to what you were saying about culture. A long time ago, actually it was in my American Literature high school textbook, there was a quote by Mark Twain, and I was never able to find the source of the quote, but he basically said that in slave-owning cultures, the slave owner's culture declines, and in fact it's the slave culture that's developed. And that fascinated me because in the 60s they said African Americans didn't have a culture. And your comments about the flourishing of culture during the slave period is the first time I've ever heard anyone outside of that quote from Mark Twain. But you didn't take the extension that he did. He seems to feel that the slave-owning culture cannot thrive under slavery.
I think when you say culture, I guess you're defining culture as a system of prize values.
No, I'm talking about, I thought he was talking about literature, art, and music, right. And design.
Well, I think culture is a product of human interactions, and it takes a variety of different forms, as we see in very constrained situations and in situations of great prosperity. You know, slaveholders had, of course, much greater material resources than the people they owned. They too created a culture. The values we put on that culture, I think, are up to us. I think probably it might be maybe the best way to think about that question is to think about the question that slaves and slaveholders lived in very close proximity. They influenced each other in a whole variety of different ways and shared many aspects of their culture. A slaveholder who worked in the fields with his slaves or supervised his slaves in the field, inevitably picked up many of their habits, many of the idioms of their speech. He came home, he or she passed them on to his children in the kind of unconscious way that culture is transposed. Slaveholders were raised by slave women who nursed them, who took care of them, and so on. So culture moves in all kinds of directions. And ultimately, what we're saying is that within the slave population, there's much of European culture as well as Native American culture, and amongst the white or European descendant slaveholding population, there's much of West Africa. We, as a people, are a product of the coming together of Europe, West Africa, and Native America. And we're influenced in ways which we can, some of which are very visible, and some of which we need truckloads of anthropologists to tease out.
I think so, because when I think about it, I can't think of a great Southern writer from that period. There's no James Fenimore Cooper or Nathaniel Hawthorne that's coming from that area, so. In fact, what you have from there are the Uncle Remus stories. So I guess this is just a superficial looking at it, mm-hmm. but I'm just wondering, has anyone ever examined that issue? Well,
there are many students of Southern literature who study both the literature of the plantation and the literature which will be later formalized of slaves that comes out of folk tales and stories and so on. And we talk about the Joel Chandler Harris. Well, Joel Chandler Harris, in doing the Uncle Remus stories, of course, is expropriating many of the stories. Which are stories which come out of West Africa, traditional African folk tales. And, of course, he's giving them a particular spin, a particular twist, in which he, of course, is patronizing the tellers of those stories, who he sees as genial but rather ineffective men, very different than the kind of kind of purposeful, dominant, competent men that he, of course, thinks he's one of.
That sort of supports Mark Twain's contention, though, mm-hmm. again, that the mm-hmm. slaveholder's culture is suppressed, and it is the slave's culture that begins mm-hmm. to dominate.
I'd like to hold to the position that they're mixed up and. In a variety of ways, but I think you've got a position as well. Okay?
All right.
Well, thank you for the call. Let me introduce again our guest. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Ira Berlin. He's distinguished university professor at the history... Let me try that once again. He's an historian at University of Maryland. He's a distinguished university professor there and is one of the country's leading scholars of slavery in North America. And he's written several books. The most recent is Generations of Captivity, A History of African American Slaves. And this spring, he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to teach and talk about this very subject. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Professor Berlin, like the caller before last, I was fascinated by your criteria for slavery. You said you can't have slavery without force and without the power of the state. I agree with that criteria, but the reason that it fascinated me so much was because under those criteria, the Bible does not allow true slavery. Because in the Bible, the power of the state favored the slave. Allow me to quote the biblical law which favored the slave. This is from Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, the 15th and 16th verses of the 23rd chapter of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 23, the 15th and 16th verses. You shall not give up to his master a servant who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst, where he chooses, in one of your towns, where it pleases him best. You shall not defraud or oppress him. That's what the Bible says about escaped slaves. And clearly, anyone holding a slave in biblical times had to be so good to that slave that the slave would not run away. Because if the slave did run away, the law favored him, the slaveholder would probably never get him back. And by the way, in the Bible, the word slave is almost never used. It's almost always called, he's almost always called a servant rather than a slave.
Well, the Bible, the Quran, probably every sacred text of every major religion of every major civilization in some ways deals with slavery, often as in the paragraph that you read from Deuteronomy, it provides protection for slaves. And, of course, in so doing, it's, of course, recognizing the slaveholders' rights. When slaveholders in the modern period, slaveholders in the United States, but slaveholders elsewhere in the world, come to defend the institution, they point to the Bible, they point to the Quran, they point to Roman law, they point to common law. They find support for the institution of slavery. In other words, in providing protection for slaves, these texts are also legitimating the institution of slavery.
Yeah.
We can say one more thing about the law. The law, with all, of course, its protective force, is a standard. We have standards in our own laws today, and sometimes they're obeyed, and sometimes they're not. In a slave society, in a society where the slaveholder is the dominant, where the slaveholder is the judges, sits in the legislature, is the executive, when those laws come to be enforced, they're generally enforced in such a way as they're not quite as kind to slaves as a fair reading of those laws would allow. In other words, in studying the law as we would study the law, and with respect to other institutions, we not only have to take into consideration the law itself, but who's enforcing the law.
Yeah, during when slaves were being held in America, pre-Civil War, there were fugitive slave laws. Slaves were beaten. I know that many of the people in the South tried to use the Bible to justify slavery, but the Bible certainly would not have permitted them to have fugitive slave laws, certainly would not have permitted them to beat their slaves, because if they beat their slaves, the slaves would run away. And the Bible said that the citizens at large should have protected that runaway slave, not given him back to his master. Mm. That was not what our slavery laws stated in America.
That's correct.
No. Right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go on to another caller here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, you know, since you talked about, your guest talked about movies that try to treat slavery, last week I saw a movie called Dogville, which is being considered a controversial movie, but it, for those people who are interested in the psychology of the tendency to enslave people, it's a very intense examination of that. So I thought I'd mention that. And that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about something else, and again, forgive me for going back to this piece that I started out with, the piece from 97, where you wrote that studying slavery can teach us much about ourselves as men and women, as Americans, as white or black, or neither, or both, or more. But perhaps the most important lesson is that slavery was only tangentially and belatedly about race. Later on here in the next paragraph, you write, while slavery formulated notions of race, it also shaped relations among white people between rich and poor, high and low. Can you talk about class and how perhaps American notions of class have also been shaped by the experience of slavery?
Well, the system of slavery, of course, becomes color-coded. And identified as between white slaveholders and black slaves, although as in any system, there are outliers and there are, of course, black slaveholders and there are probably some people who are largely European who are held as slaves. We know whiteness and blackness is defined very ambiguously. Mm-hmm. But what's the system of slavery is? It's a system of dominations whose purpose is not to in some ways elevate all white people over all black people, over all Europeans, over all Africans. The system of slavery is a system which is purpose is to elevate some people. They turn out to be European and white, some people over everybody else. And that's, of course, what the system does. As we know, the majority of white Southerners are not slaveholders. Slaveholders and their families make up a very small proportion of the Southern population. And, of course, if we view it in terms of the history of the population of the entire United States, it's still even a smaller fraction of that. Yet, those slaveholders are able to dominate the federal government through the control of the presidency, through the control over the court system, through the control over Congress for most of our history as a as a nation. Slavery ultimately thus is a system of class domination, which becomes then mixed up and mystified by the question of a question of race. These are two separate categories and ways of thinking, which then become twisted amongst themselves, very, very difficult to separate, and perhaps in trying to separate them, we do an injustice to the way their entanglement has created exactly who we are.
We have a few other callers. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. Somebody on a we'll go next to line number two in Champaign.
Hello, Professor. I'm a Southerner by birth, African-American, grew up in Arkansas near the Little Rock Central, so I'm well-versed in many of the issues. My question to you is a practice that existed in Arkansas and throughout the South after the ratification of the 13th Amendment. abolishing legally slavery. That is peonage, and something even maybe less insidious that went on in my area, sharecropping. Do you discuss peonage and how it perhaps, in many of its vestiges, may have been worse for African Americans than slavery?
In my writing, no, I have not addressed the question of peonage. In fact, I kind of barely get into the period of emancipation. I do, of course, teach at the University of Maryland a course in the history of the South. I also teach a course in labor history where we address questions of peonage. The demise of the system of slavery necessitates the creation of a whole variety of different kinds of practices and institutions to extract people's labor, to assure the dominance of those people who are sitting on top of American society at that particular moment. We've talked earlier about segregation and disenfranchisement, and we can fit peonage and varieties of forms of sharecropping and share wages, tenancy, into that, that array of institutions which developed in the post-emancipation world.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks. Next caller is in southeastern Illinois. It's line 4. Hello.
Yes, and I don't mean this to be taken as a defense of slavery because it was a bad thing, and I'm not defending it in any way. So far as I know, none of my ancestors were slaveholders. However, a couple of prominent blacks that I know of have my same last name, so I don't know whether they got those from a slaveholder or some abolitionist figure that they admired or something. But anyway, I think it should be put in the context of what things were like elsewhere on Bill Maher's program before he bounced off the air. A white panelist on the show made a remark. There was a black panelist on the show, and a white panelist, who I believe was Jewish, made the remark that when his people came over, there weren't any cushy plantation jobs waiting for them. It was a joke, of course, but I think a lot of times what people believed, it's already been made by another guest on this program some time ago that that debt slavery was in fact worse than chattel slavery because the chattel slaveholder had a monetary investment and that slave was worth something to them, and they, assuming that they weren't just naturally cruel, if they had any monetary sense, they took care of it because it was worth something, where a debt slave indentured for 7 years, perhaps. I mean, they could work them to death in 7 years because at the end of the 7 years, they weren't going to have anything out of them anyway. The movie, Gangs of New York, I didn't watch the whole thing because they didn't want to see it, but things weren't very good for white folks in New York City about that time.
We're at the point here where we're almost out of time. Can you make some response?
Benny Goodman was quoted in on the David Burns jazz thing as saying that when he was at home, there were days when there wasn't much to eat. And he went on to say, he said there was nothing to eat. And he said, I don't mean that there wasn't very much to eat. I mean there wasn't anything to eat.
I think what we can say is that slaves are not the only people who have experienced oppression. And I don't think anybody would deny that.
And I'm just going to have to jump in here because, and I'm sorry, we have some other folks that we just can't take, but we are at the end of the time. We have used our time. For people who are interested in reading more of the work of our guest, Ira Berlin, you might look for his most recent book. It was published last year. It's titled Generations of Captivity, A History of African-American Slaves. And then if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, he will be giving a talk on the topic Rethinking Slavery, 1800 to 1861. It's free and open to the public at 3:30 in the afternoon on Friday, April 9th. 213 Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. He is our guest, Ira Berlin's professor at University of Maryland, and this spring is here visiting to teach and talk here on the campus of the University of Illinois. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.